From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. On Saturday, May 30th, a new era of human spacecraft began as American astronauts once again launched aboard an American rocket from American soil to the International Space Station as part of NASA's Commercial Crew Program. On this morning's show, we have a couple of guests that were very important to this launch. I spoke with Deputy Administrator for NASA, Jim Morhard, who was in Cape Canaveral getting ready for the historic flight that lifted off 2 hours later. Jim helps provide overall leadership, planning, and policy direction for NASA. He's also responsible for articulating and representing the agency's vision to Congress and the world. Here now is that taped conversation. Jim Morhard, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hey, John, thank you for having me today. It's a real honor.
Well, it's an honor to have you, sir. I mean, this is so exciting for us. First time U.S. astronauts from U.S. soil in 11 years. What does this mean for Americans to have the ability to launch from our own soil?
You know, John, this is about having unfettered access to space. And you think about NASA, the reality is, you know, you're in my life. NASA developed, built, and launched and operated spacecraft and rockets. And this is the first time where we're going to have a commercial company build the rocket and the spacecraft and send American astronauts into space. Why is that important? You know the challenges we have financially in the United States right now. And this is going to be where we, NASA, become a customer, hopefully one of many customers, to the commercial industry. And there's such a demand for research up at the space station right now. We've got one astronaut there. And if we're able to certify this launch and mission, we'll be able to start sending complements of four astronauts at a time up to the station. That's going to increase research and development by 300%. There is such a demand for it. And when I say that, I'm talking about such things as, you know, trying to build human tissue in space. Can't do it on Earth because of the gravity. The cells collapse. But in microgravity, it works. We found immunizations for salmonella, which isn't a big issue in the United States, but it is overseas. And we've saved hundreds and thousands of lives because of it. We're doing research on pancreatic cancer. We're looking at fiber optics and trying to make them more pure so we have less relay stations. It just goes on and on. So the demand's there. And what we expect is that there will be a growth in the supply. We really expect we'll have commercial space stations in the future. And this allows the commercial industry to really expand the economy in low Earth orbit so NASA can focus on getting to the moon, being sustainably there, and really prepare to go to Mars and deep space.
Well, it's all very exciting. And one of the missions that I've got my eye on is Artemis, and that's sending the first woman and the next man to the moon by 2024. How does today's mission advance that mission?
Yeah, you know, Artemis was Apollo's sister in Greek mythology. And I think Homer called her the torch bringer. And that's exactly what we're doing with the first woman landing on the moon. As far as this mission, we need a space transportation system that's been working for a while. We in the United States aren't used to human spaceflight. We're seeing it when people are saying, oh my gosh, we scrubbed this. Well, Doug Hurley was telling me the other day, they scrubbed five shuttle launches for him at one time. This is rocket science. It's complicated. So we're gonna do what's safe for our astronauts. But we need this one to get our muscle memory as far as launching astronauts into space. We also need to do long duration missions on the International Space Station, because it takes 6 to 9 months to get just to get to Mars, let alone stay there and come back. And they're, you know, the most complicated system that we've got is still the human system. And that's really what we've got to make sure that we continue to keep the health of our astronauts as our priority.
Let me ask you, Jim, what is one of your first memories of the U.S. space program going back?
Oh, you give me chills.
Yeah.
My father was designing airplanes for the Navy in Northern Virginia. And my first memory, I was 6 years old, and I remember getting out of my parents' white Ford station wagon. There was a hinge on the back window, and my brother Jay was nine, and he took my hand, and we walked up this sidewalk to this house. It was a rambler, one-story brick house. He knocked on the door, and this man, the crew cut, opened the door and let us in, and my brother asked him for his autograph, and he offered us a glass of water, and we pet his cat, and that was the first time I met John Glenn. I later was working in the Senate on the Appropriations Committee, was the what they call the clerk of the Military Construction Subcommittee, and he was a senator from Ohio, and he had that, he was chairman of that committee on the Armed Services Committee, so we worked very closely together, and I remember being on the Senate subway and telling him that story, and you know, he was the same kind man many years later, just that had the grace and the wisdom that he exhibited when he did his first orbits around the Earth.
Oh, that's a great story. You know, last year I was with Charlie Precourt, who is a decorated shuttle astronaut and commander, has over 750 hours in space. And he and I were invited to a screening of the Apollo 11 documentary, and I interviewed him afterwards. So we were sitting together during the screening. And when Neil finally touched down on the moon, I turned to Charlie and I said, you know, 50 years later, it still gives me goosebumps. Now, here's a guy that used to run test. He was a test pilot. He was a service member. He's many, many hours in space. He turns to me wide-eyed and said, me too. I can't believe we did it. So it was very exciting, even going back 50 years ago, just a very exciting time for us. And the real excitement, of course, as you have described, is in the future and where we're going to be going. So, you know, hats off to NASA and all of the missions that you have. One of the other things that's unmanned, but certainly keeps us safe, we had Dr. Nikki Fox on the program last week. She runs heliophysics for you, as you know,
yes,
study of the sun. And there are so many missions and programs and early warning systems for solar weather that will keep our planet safe. And all of this has happened in the last 10, 12, maybe 15 years. So there's a lot of good things going on at NASA.
Yeah, there are. And, you know, you talk about those programs. I mean, we really don't necessarily understand the sun as much as we need to in the solar weather. And it makes a difference. It would have made a difference had Apollo 11 been there later, just a little bit later. It would have been a lot different mission. So we're trying to learn about the sun, the coronal mass injections. There's a lot of parts of it that we're doing. But the other program I want to mention, if I could, and that's, you know, in July, there's a window of opportunity starts July 17th where the planets are aligned. I can't believe I'm saying that, but the planets are aligned. I feel like it's the age of Aquarius. And, but with that, we're going to send a mission called Perseverance, which is so appropriate in our time right now in history of what everybody's so challenged. But it's going to go to Mars, and we're actually going to have a helicopter on it. And the helicopter is really a demonstration of whether the atmosphere in Mars can support air flight. And if it can, we can use this helicopter as a forward scout for our astronauts, which will really reduce some of the risks that we've got. We're also going to be looking at how, if we can turn CO2 into oxygen. We're going to bring up samples of the astronauts' outer layer of what they're going to be wearing when they get to Mars, as well as their face shield, to see if it can handle the environment there. So we've got the other thing is the entry, landing and entry, descent, landing and entry. And you think about it, we've landed 8 times on Mars, but we also have a number of very expensive craters on Mars. There's a reason why they call the landing 7 minutes of terror. And so we're really trying to get more data on that so that, we reduce the risk and bring it within the margins so that we do have successful landings. You know, we had 23 precursor missions before Apollo 11. This is one of the precursor missions that we've got before we land on Mars. So we're already, you know, we've really got a 3-tier effort going on. It's Mars, it's cislunar space with the moon and its orbits, and then low Earth orbit. And we're working all three at the same time. Our intent at NASA is one, to inspire the next generation so that we continue to explore. I think it's in our DNA to be explorers, but it's also to give people hope. There are a lot of people suffering right now, and it's up to us, you know, to send that message. And instead of hope, hopefully folks will have compassion and love, and we hope to unite the United States with this launch today. So that's what we're about.
Jim, thank you very much for your time this morning. I hope we can talk again soon.
It'd be my honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim.
And that was a taped interview. Unfortunately, I missed out on, but John, What a wonderful opportunity to talk to him, the administrator of NASA, on the day of the launch, May 30th.
He has a lot of enthusiasm, and he has some pretty good ideas, too.
Absolutely. That was James Morehard. Well, now, since 2012, SpaceX has flown many unmanned resupply missions to the International Space Station. On May 30th, of course, NASA astronauts Robert Behnken and Douglas Hurley, better known as Bob and Doug, flew on SpaceX's Crew Dragon spacecraft, lifting off on a Falcon 9 rocket from U.S. soil. This is the final flight test for SpaceX. This mission will validate the company's crew transportation system, including the launch pad, rocket, spacecraft, and operational capabilities. Our next guest is Michael Horkachuk. He works for NASA, and he manages the relationship with SpaceX for the Commercial Crew Program. Mike Horkachuk, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hello there.
It's really great
nice
to have
young.
You. Great. Yeah. Well, good morning. And, Mike, I can't imagine after more than 3 decades at NASA what it was like on May 30th. I know for anyone who was viewing it, from goosebumps to a lump in the throat to downright sobbing, watching that, what did you feel?
Oh, yeah, I had the goosebumps and the lump in my throat until the vehicle got into orbit. And quite honestly, as we were going through the countdown, even the night before, I thought weather was going to get us one more time. You know, we had to scrub the launch a couple of days before because of lightning in the area near the pad.
Right.
And the weather reports as late as the night before were still showing some potential thunderstorms along the abort track as well as right there over the pad. And luckily, it all cleared out, moved a little bit faster than the models were predicting, and we got to launch the vehicle. And it was a pretty launch. All the vehicle systems seemed to be performing really well. We had very few problems during the countdown, and it was an amazingly smooth mission getting the vehicle into orbit.
And for those of us watching at home, the lead up for the 2 hours before the launch was so exciting, just going through everything from what was going to transpire during the launch to looking at the astronauts, to looking at the construction and the design of their spacesuits. It was so exciting. And so I just can't even imagine how it was for you. But I'm curious, you have been at NASA for 32 years or so.
Right.
And I would only imagine that this current capacity where you're managing the relationship between NASA and SpaceX must be just about the most interesting and unique thing that you've done or role that you've played in your entire time at NASA. Can you tell us about it?
Oh, yeah. It's fun working with SpaceX because things change so quickly. You'll be down on the shop floor. So they have the engineering and the manufacturing sort of co-located. So you can go down and look at the hardware that they're producing. And in the matter of a week, they could have rearranged things and moved hardware around. They've added lots of things as they continue to build. It just is constantly bustling, which you don't see at all aerospace companies and all projects that NASA works on. So, it's a lot of fun. I was the actual NASA project manager when we gave SpaceX the first contract to build a cargo vehicle. So the first mission that they did to the space station, that cargo vehicle, was under that initial contract. And that was a lot of fun as well. Just the speed at which they design hardware, test it. If they find a problem, they'll redesign it, fix it, and get it all put together. And yeah, it was pretty impressive to see them launch an unmanned vehicle from a dead standstill, get it up to 17,500 miles an hour, and then rendezvous with a space station that's going 17,500 miles an hour, get the two to line up and rendezvous and dock with the space station. Mm-hmm. It's quite a feat.
Michael, it's great to have you back on Cool Science Radio. Thank you for spending time with us. When Lynn and I hit the wrong buttons here at the station, nobody gets hurt. You guys have so much responsibility. And from our perspective, the launch, the docking with ISS, it was all flawless. And you were on console during all of this. Was there anything that surprised you?
You know, not really. It was all really smooth. There were a few minor alarms that went off through the mission, but they were mostly just some transition things as it was changing from one state to the other, and they had not necessarily set the alarms correctly. You know, it's a test flight, so sometimes you want to put a lot of automated alarms into the system to warn the operators that something might be happening, and then the really smart people that know that subsystem can decide whether it's a real problem or just inhibit the alarm. So there were a few of those, but in general, the systems worked really, really well.
And you have responsibility for structures, dynamics, the docking system, communication, tracking. There's so many, you know, the environmental control, life support systems, safety and mission assurance, but there's also the avionics. Because that software, is that... can I assume that might be the most challenging piece that needs to be worked on continuously?
Avionics in a traditional system is usually the most expensive and longest lead items in a project. For SpaceX, they design a lot of it in-house, so they have a lot more control over the design and how fast it gets built, and then they build all their own software. And then they have a bunch of test beds. We'd call them flat sats or the equivalent of all the avionics boxes on the flight vehicle, but on a table in the lab. And they'll test the software out on those tables to make sure that it works the way we expect it to work. And they'll do hundreds, if not thousands, of rods with all kinds of different failures injected into it to make sure the software performs the way we expect it to. So in traditional systems, I'd say avionics and software are high risk and long lead. For this program, parachutes had been a big challenge. Just making sure that we had the right design of the parachutes and had tested them enough times to have real confidence in them. You know, they're soft goods, so it's a little harder to use the typical engineering methods on designing these big soft jellyfish-like things that when you see them deploy in the air. So you do a lot of testing to make sure that they really work the way that we expected them to. In fact, we put the latest version of the parachutes on the in-flight abort test that happened in January, and they performed great. And then we did two more tests after that to make sure that the integrated system was going to perform correctly. Right in the middle of this whole coronavirus pandemic, we were still out there with SpaceX doing drop tests from a C-130 to make sure that the parachute system was going to be good for the astronauts to come back in when they eventually come back from the space station.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Michael Horkachuk. He works for NASA, and he manages the relationship with SpaceX for the Commercial Crew Program. And Mike, going back to this relationship, I think the whole world is looking at, you know, NASA partnering with private enterprise. And, you know, NASA, you could look at it as a more bureaucratic, slow-moving organization with people like yourself who've worked there for your entire career or nearly 32 years. And then at SpaceX, people, you know, the average age is probably much, much younger than at NASA. They're very nimble. As you say, everything is fast moving. And yet, you know, at the helm, Elon Musk, people think of him as a little bit of maybe a live wire and unpredictable. And I'm just so curious about how you deal with that relationship and what are the biggest victories about that relationship, and what are the biggest concerns?
Let's see. I think the biggest victory for all of us is that it's a fixed price contract. Mm. So when they say they're going to do something, we hold them to meeting those requirements. And when they meet them, then they get paid. And if they don't meet them, they don't get paid. So there isn't the huge cost overruns that some more traditional cost-plus contracting has happened in the past. You know, big government contracts that are cost-plus. Even if you're building a house, right? How many people have had their contractor say, it's going to cost
order.
A little more than I thought? Yeah. In this case, we don't see a lot of that. And the other thing that I really like specifically about SpaceX is if we find a problem and we jointly agree and SpaceX are convinced that it really is a problem, they just go fix it. It's not the traditional cost plus contract where you have to write a change order, get a proposal back from the contractor, negotiate that, eventually put it on contract, and then they make the change. SpaceX wants to build the right thing and build a vehicle that is really safe for the astronauts. So they go fix it when they see a problem.
Yeah, that's great. And then what's the biggest challenge?
Sometimes just the cultural difference in the way that a lot of the NASA engineers have been used to dealing with our contractors and then learning how to work with SpaceX. So just the conversation somehow sometimes have to be a little bit different so that they understand we're coming from, and we let them explain where they're coming from.
Michael, I'm curious, you have a counterpart that manages the Boeing relationship, is that correct?
Yeah, I don't specifically manage the overall contract. I'm in the plant helping, and there is a counterpart at the Boeing facility.
And how are things going with Boeing? I know that they had one small problem, and they still have some testing to do for certification. Is it NASA's desire to have two different spacecraft, two separate programs that can be called upon?
Yeah, I think one thing that we've learned with the space station is it's good to have the similar redundancy. Space flight is hard, and sometimes you'll run into a problem that you didn't see before, and it'll ground that particular vehicle. You won't fly it until you've gotten to the root cause of what the problem is and fixed it on either the rocket or the spacecraft. And having a completely separate design to be able to continue to fly and provide logistics and astronaut turnaround to the space station is very important. Relying on just one design gets very risky.
Well, we certainly learned that also with the shuttle program.
True.
So that would have been, that would have been nice. Are you responsible for the Falcon 9 coming back down and landing on the drone ship, or is that somebody else?
That's pretty much all SpaceX. So our mission requirements are to get the Dragon spacecraft into orbit. And what they do with the first stage after that is their own choice. So the way we structured the contract, it lets them innovate and come up with ways of recovering the first stage. I remember back in the very early days, they were trying to parachute the first stages back, similar to what we did with the shuttle solid rocket motors on the two sides of the shuttle. After they run their course, they parachute back into the ocean and we recover them out of the ocean. Early on, SpaceX tried that, but it didn't work very well. And then eventually they learned how to do this propulsive landing. And what can you say? It's worked out spectacularly.
Well, as a kid watching Flash Gordon, they'd have this cheesy rocket that basically was going in reverse and landing just like the Falcon 9. I mean, it's just incredible.
Yeah, and that's a big part of Elon's drive to make this cost effective. You know, he's often said, I think, that if passenger airline travel, you built a 747 to take you from New York to England, and you only flew it once and threw it away like we did with previous boosters, nobody could afford to fly. But that's not what we do. We land and we inspect it and we put more gas in the vehicle, in the airplane, and then we fly it again. And you keep doing that, and then you maybe do a major overhaul and fly it again after that. But you don't throw it away every time. And he's trying to get the rocket business to be more similar to what we do with airplanes. Hmm. Obviously, the environment is dramatically different, but you can reuse them a few times at least.
Yeah, I think for us, we lay people out there, really to see the return of the rocket to the launch pad or to the barge that's out in the ocean has really been the most fascinating, just amazing work of physics, that I've ever seen. It is just incredible. If we're looking at, most of us watch the launch and maybe we kind of tuned in the next day to know that the astronauts made it to the International Space Station. What are they doing now? And what are their daily routines right now?
Okay. So in the first few weeks that the vehicle has been up there, there have been a bunch of tests to make sure the systems work correctly with the space station. They've checked what we call the safe haven capability, which means if something were to happen on board the space station, the astronauts could evacuate to the spacecraft, close the hatch, and kind of wait to see if it stabilized on the space station and then go back in, or whether they'd have to depart. So they checked some of the computer systems that there was good communication and could set things up. They've inspected some of the windows after launch to see if the quality of the view out the windows has changed from the launch. Just a number of various checkout steps and emergency response kind of procedures that they've walked through on board the space station to make sure everything was ready and safe and working in this new vehicle as it's connected to the space station. And now I think they're going to help out with the rest of the space station crew doing some of the science that's on board the space station.
How many astronauts are at the space station right now from various countries?
I think there are five. Okay. There are two Russians, one other U.S. astronaut, and then Doug and Bob.
How are those spacesuits holding up and treating them?
I think they've worked very well. They're certainly a lot sleeker than we've seen in the spacesuits in the past.
Yeah.
One of the things that's nice about them is they have all the pieces attached so you don't lose things while you're up on the space station, like a glove or a helmet. They're all together, and you can't misplace them. Now, these are not the same kind of spacesuits that you use to do an EVA and be out in space for 6 hours. These are mostly entry and landing kind of spacesuits, similar to the escape suits that the shuttle had.
Yeah. Wow. That's great. Well, Michael Horkachuk, we're so glad that you could join us again here on Cool Science Radio. Michael is the manager of the relationship between NASA and SpaceX for the Commercial Crew Program. Mike, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
It's great being on again.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.